set?
Okay. First thing I want you to do is to
drink some coffee.
Try to look at the two cameras at once and say, "I'm Richard Gordon. I'm Richard Gordon.
I'm Dick Gordon, Commander USN."
No, no.
How's
command
that?
Command module pilot, Apollo 12. Okay. They want to use these little
sure.
clips.
Sure. I'll get it.
Is everybody rolling?
Yeah, we don't have any.
Are we all set? Rolling, Charlie?
Terry, let Sue Bean in if she comes back. She may come to watch all
ready?
This.
I'm Dick Gordon, Command Module Pilot on Apollo 12.
Fine, that looked good to me. The first thing I want to do with you then is just a biographical routine. Just talk about you, and we did this before.
Right, go.
We'll update it. Dick Gordon, you're in space again. How does it feel to be back after that wonderful Gemini 11 flight that you and Pete Conrad pulled off several years ago?
Well, I hope that I'm looking forward to this being just as exciting as that one was, and I'm sure it will be.
I think it should be more so, don't you?
Well, I don't know. Each experience that happens to you has to be exciting in its own right. Gemini 11 was the first experience for me in space. This is a second. It's not an unknown environment to me, so those aspects of it I'm familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
All the Earth orbital phases and operating in that particular environment are not new. And although they'll be exciting, they obviously can't be as exciting as something that happened to you previous to that. But things like TLI and Translunar Coast, Trans-Earth Coast, and of course the lunar orbit activities have got to be exciting as well.
This is the first time we've had an all-Navy crew aboard a spacecraft. Tell me a bit about your background.
Well, it really isn't the first time. Gemini 11 was an all-Navy crew, but if you're referring to Apollo, you're correct. My background is basically one of being a naval aviator since graduating from the University of Washington in 51, making several deployments with fleet squadrons, both to the Mediterranean and to the Far East, being a test pilot. Starting that career in 1957, working at the test center as a project test pilot until early 60.
Which test center?
At the Naval Air Test Center, Patuxent River, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only one the Navy has okay. in that regard. They have other test centers, but not the same as that one.
That's just south of Washington, a few
yes,
months.
It is. Surely is. And then, of course, upon leaving the test center, going to Naval Air Station Miramar, San Diego, California, where helped to introduce the F-4 to the fleet and deployed with a second squadron we trained to the Far East, spending a small amount of time at the Navy Postgraduate School in Monterey before, just prior to being selected as an astronaut. And of course, the remaining part of my career has been spent in this program.
What kind of planes did you fly then?
Well, just about everything that the Navy was flying at that time. Basically, I'm a fighter pilot, and those are the type of airplanes that I was involved with.
And you've been here in Houston in the astronaut program since when?
Was selected in late 63 and moved to Houston, arrived on New Year's Day in 1964.
And your family's here? How many children?
Yes, they are. I have six children.
Six children?
The same as the last time you talked to me.
And where were you from originally? I'm
from Seattle, Washington.
Your wife from the Northwest?
Yes, she's from Seattle also. We both attended the University of Washington.
Good luck throughout this mission, Dick, and I hope you get them back safely.
Thank you. So do I.
All right, then let's go into we'll keep rolling. Some of your command module pilot duties. Just. Dick, would you describe the principal function of the command module pilot in the various phases of this mission?
Well, I think by and large, it's fairly simple to describe those. It's basically the same as Mike's was. We jokingly, I guess maybe not jokingly, call ourselves the bus drivers. Pete and Al get in, I say leave the driving to me, and away we go. It is a challenge in its own right. I am basically responsible, or have that responsibility, after the launch and after the insertion in the Translunar Coast, of being cognizant of the command module itself. Obviously, they're there, and they're with me, and they know a great deal about it. But I think Pete has genuinely left that responsibility with me, and he's counted on me to fulfill that task of making sure that the command module does its job. In other words, it gets them to lunar orbit, It fulfills its requirement for getting the lunar module ready. It stands by in all cases to rescue the limb in the event that that has to be done, and of course we all hope that it doesn't. That's a formidable task in itself. Being responsible for the rendezvous itself after their lunar surface activities are completed. I think in that aspect you'll find that the one-man operation of the command and service module, which was basically designed to have three men operate it, has taken a great deal of time and a great deal of consideration of just how does that transpire. And it has evolved into a very precise process. I think the aspect of rendezvous, the backup portion of it, the docking that the command module is active in, the jettisoning of the limb, and then of course all of this activity that we are doing after our portion of the lunar surface is done to support the follow-on flights is really important. I think we can't really emphasize on this enough. If we're really going to do exciting things and go to interesting places on a lunar surface, more interesting, I'm not to say that this one isn't, but to really explore the lunar surface, we need a lot more information about these places, and this is what we hope to obtain. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, coming back home, the navigation that must be done, and the entry itself. These are the things that I'm responsible for.
Now, you're pretty busy during that lunar landing period, one man holding down a three-man spacecraft up there in orbit, aren't you?
Well, that probably is not the busiest time by myself in the command module. I think it's more of a passive role in that regard. I watch them go down as much as I can, but I'm there in the advent that something does happen. I am really very passive at that particular time. If you're looking for an area that's probably the most significant of one man operating the command and service module, it will probably be that area where I have to make a plane change. Now, Apollo 11 had one planned, but since they were in an equatorial orbit, they really didn't need it. Now, we're going into lunar orbit with a 15-degree inclination, and the lunar stay of 32 hours dictates that there must be a plane change made by the command module to pass over the landing site during the day of liftoff. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an SPS engine burn of some 275 to 300 feet per second. It'll obviously be calculated in real time. But there is one case where one man has to perform the functions of three, which would normally be done.
In other words, a major burn like that require a lot of preparation.
That's correct.
In the spacecraft. Why is that so? What are you having to do? Align the platform?
Well, it's a matter of being three places in the spacecraft at one time. This is significantly what it is, and we have arranged the functions that must take place sequentially so that I can actually move across the cockpit. There are certain functions that Al would normally perform in a right-hand seat that I have to take care of. And there are certain functions that Pete, when all three of us are there, would normally take care of if he were there. So I've got to take care of all three of these jobs and make the burn itself. So we've tried to organize the whole aspect of making a major burn in the command module so that one man can adequately and safely handle it.
Good luck, Dick.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you want to stop a sec?
Roll sound, roll camera.
Roll sound. Give it again.
Once again.
Thank you.
Dick, we've heard much discussion about the importance of all of this photography to be done on the last day in lunar orbit, after rendezvous, after the lunar module returns, after Pete and Al are back in the command module with you, when you prepare to dispense with the lunar module. Basically, all of this photography is to help future missions, right?
It certainly is, and I think it's a very vital aspect of this flight. It's an added feature, you might say, of our flight, and if you really look at it, it's exactly what Apollo 8 did on their flight. We've tacked that on as an addition to ours. But that's an indication, I think, only of the amount of activity we'll be doing. And it is all basically surveying and basically photography for future Apollo flights. I think to make the future of Apollo interesting captivating and certainly scientifically valuable, we must go to the areas on the lunar surface that are the most interesting significantly as far as geology is concerned. Mm-hmm. Now, proposed landing sites for future missions have been three areas that we are vitally interested in. One of them is Lalande.
Now, what is this, a crater area?
These basically are highland areas. They are crater areas, but there are mountainous terrains and highland areas associated with it. Descartes and Framaro. Framaro is just to the east of our own landing site, but it's in the highland area to the east of Site 7.
Highland, rough terrain, mountains?
Yes, that's exactly right. And unfortunately, for training purposes, the ranger pictures of these particular areas leave a little bit to be desired as far as our requirements are concerned.
You say Ranger. Now, this was an early photographic spacecraft.
That's correct.
Do we have lunar orbiter or surveyor pictures of any of these?
I think all of those have added to the information and the photography that we have of these areas, mm-hmm. but they are not adequate to do the job that we're talking about.
For future manned missions.
That's correct.
In these areas.
That's correct. Because
now what are you
to land in highland areas, I think you must recognize that you've got to find an area that is suitable for landing. You can't land a limb on the side of a mountain. That ought to be obvious. And I think we've got to detail these areas well enough so that we can find adequate landing areas. But not only do they have to be adequately found, they have to be adequately identified and charted so that we know exactly where they are. Plus the fact that the techniques of spot landing with the limb have to be developed. We haven't done it yet. We're going to attempt it on this one. But the more we try and the more we do this, I think the more we'll learn so that someday we can, in fact, park that limb on a plateau that's right alongside of a mountain. Now, this is the type of thing we're interested in. Several of these things that we'll be doing will be strip photography of the areas leading in to these landing points. In other words, recognition of specific features that give us this ability to track inbound to the target. Plus some high-resolution photography with a 500-millimeter lens where we employ the technique of target motion compensation so that we can get the resolution that is inherent in the equipment, something like 1 meter from 60 miles.
You mean the resolution of your pictures will be within 1 meter from
60 miles with a 500-millimeter lens? That's correct, if we can properly employ the target motion. In other words, if we can adequately point the camera at the target as we're going over it so that there is no motion on the film, that the resolution can be down to 1 meter. Now, these are the type of pictures you have to have so that people can really study the terrain and find the areas that are suitable for landing the limb. There are two other significant aspects of this. One is a strip photography. I guess I mentioned that, of strip photography of the track inbound to these targets so people can recognize where they are. The other aspect of it is tying down where these areas are on the lunar surface so that navigational processes will be more accurate.
Is part of the strip photography this complete track of the moon from
yes,
during one full pass?
We're doing that on two passes. We're doing it with the sextant camera, we call it the DAC, which is a data acquisition camera, mounted on the sextant and tracking in a stereo strip all the way across this particular track. Additionally, we use the P-22 program, which is a landmark tracking program and a command module that we can track a specific spot and through the process of the program come up with a longitude, latitude, and altitude for that particular item that we're looking at or that particular landmark. And tying our particular orbit to that landmark allows us to adequately plan future missions so they can use these same features in the same areas and they'll know exactly where they are.
Well, all of the training which you've done for this mission has drawn heavily on those pictures available from previous flights up till now. You mentioned
Unfortunately, we haven't had that particular opportunity. This site was a brand new site. It was just selected after Apollo 11 flew, and it's a relatively new site. Unfortunately, photography is not what we would like to have. We have adequate pictures and adequate photography of these areas, but certainly we could have used much more detail than we have today. Fortunately, we're going into a relatively flat, smooth area, and long as we can find our way into it and identify features to pin down our orbit in relationship to the landing site, we'll be adequately prepared. But we sure would have liked to have had better pictures of this area.
How about this multispectral photography?
Well, that's a scientific interest, of course, as a scientific experiment. It will be used in much the same manner that particular experiment was used on Apollo 9. That allows them to get the spectral phenomenon of the lunar surface for future studies and for future requirements in space. That in itself, although the pictures are of extreme significance as far as the experiment is concerned, is not nearly as important as the other aspects I've mentioned as far as future landing sites mm-hmm. are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But it will certainly allow those people in the scientific community that are interested in the type of surface that is there while we're taking the stereo strip with the S-158 experiment.
Well, we expect to see lots of good film.
So do I. We have a lot of it on board, and I hope we adequately use it.
And you're going to be busy, the three of you there, with all of the camera equipment inside the command module.
We have a bunch of it scattered around. Not only do we have the data acquisition camera on the sextant, but that also goes in the left window. There's a 500-millimeter lens that goes in the right window. There's another standard Hasselblad with the 80-millimeter lens that also goes over there. So we have plenty of it to occupy our time and perform the juggling acts that must be required to do this job.
Thanks, Dick Gordon.
Thank you.
Okay, 6, 7, 8. Hold it. Just a quickie then.
Roll it.
Steve.
Dick, how will you feel when Pete and Al both leave the spacecraft and there you are by yourself?
That's an easy one. In a word, lonely. However, I think if we all reflect upon that aspect, I think we're mentally, morally, and psychologically prepared for this, and I think there are times in everybody's life where sometimes they just like to be alone. 40 hours may be a little long, but I'll be busy enough to occupy my time, and hopefully we'll come through without any particular problems.
Your responsibility is considerable, though. You're the safety valve. You're the safety mechanism, the mothership.
Well, I like to treat it that way, and there's always that aspect of accepting that responsibility, and maybe if I do a good enough job in this regard, the next time I can land on the moon.
I hope you can do it. Good
Thank
luck.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dick Gordon.